It's the Adventures of Indiana Jim, episode 16, for the week of February 7th, 2009.
And now, coming to you not exactly live from
the Cliffs of Insanity,
a man who needs no introduction, that international man of geekery, that intrepid arch-geekologist, Indiana Jim.
Let me tell you why I suck. I'm like JoJo, the idiot circus boy, with a pretty new pet. Oh, my pretty little pet. I love you. So I stroke it, I pet it. Yeah, I love my little naughty pet. You're naughty. And then I take my naughty pet and I go. Oh! I killed it!
Indiana Jim, Indiana Jim, this is London calling. Come in, please.
And that is the story of my life. Seriously. How y'all doing? It's been a while. November, actually. Somebody said September, and somebody said October. No, November is the last time I had an episode. Not a regular episode, mind you, okay? The last time I had a regular episode was before Codename Starkeeper hit, and then, you know, it was all that all the time. You know, oh, hey, ringing in on Twitter. The Spiritual Tramp says, love your show, Jim. You need to podcast more. And I said, dude, that's a good idea. And he says, it's not original, but I'll take credit. Very good, sir. You take credit. And speaking of Scott Roche, I'm hoping, we're both hoping, to reconnoiter a little bit down in Charlotte, North Carolina. I don't know why I'm breaking into an Irish accent, but it's kind of what I do. Charlotte, North Carolina, the end of May. End of May, I am not going to sing that song. But anyway, we're going to hopefully get together down at Con Carolinas a little bit. Mr. Dubs, of course, says, I heart Ted Jim. And if I didn't look at the name, I would have sworn it was May Breakall. But, you know, it was Mr. Dubs. Michigan Brian, who, of course, stars in Metamore City. Chris Lester's little work over there. So anyway, let's catch up on old Jim, shall we?
I got a bad feeling about this.
Yeah. So what happened? Well, just to give an idea, I'm going to be giving you an interview, not the one I did with you know who, that's not Voldemort. Although it could, you know, the head is kind of the same. I digress. I'm going to be bringing you an interview with Joshua Palmateer, who, now, wait for it. I interviewed him at where? Where did I interview him at? Where?
I got a bad feeling about this.
Yes, Balticon 2008 in June. What month is it? What month is it?
I got a bad feeling about this.
February of 2009. Now, if it was February 2008, we'd really be and for some problems. So, you know, I've been sitting on it and sitting on it, and not on purpose, because just stuff has gotten in the way. I played the interview with Patricia Bray, and then I played all the Balticon stuff after that, and I sort of just kind of lost him. So, but really, here's the thing now. Joshua's novel, The Vacant Throne, is eligible for Hugo nomination. So if you are so inclined, pick up that bad boy. Check it out. I have it on great authority, i.e. Summer Brooks, that his stuff kicks royal booty, if you know what I mean. And I am not going to do that again.
He chose poorly.
Yeah, that's just not my thing, man. And copying T. Morris, though, is. So, excuse me. Now, Charlie the Beard Guy, last time I tried this, when I said nobody was responding, he said, that's exactly why I never ask for live feedback. And I, of course, replied back that people are probably too inebriated to respond to his show if they're drinking. And if they were going to respond, you know, you wouldn't be able to understand a word they said, because it would be complete and utter nonsense. So Anyway, I now will present that interview with Joshua Palmateer after my intro babble, because intro babble, really, it gets to the heart of the podcaster. That's what I think. So Con Carolinas, I'm not going to Balticon this year. Boo, yeah, whatever. I'm going to Con Carolinas to meet some people I've never met face-to-face. And, of course, Rich will be there. Podcasting's Rich Siegfried. Hey! He will be, or for those of you who are in the live Mr. Adventure, I will say, hey! Yeah. Ask Rich about Warrior 69 and see what happens. Yeah, that was good times. Good times. And I played a drill sergeant too. That was fun. Or a sergeant of some sort. So, let's talk about the Star Wars Clone Wars cartoon. If you're not watching it, let me first say the good. Not written by George Lucas. Okay, we can take some... take some comfort there. It's not written by me, though, which could present a problem. The best thing about the Clone Wars animation, I know people have complained about the character design, like, their beards look too hard, you know? Really, we've got to get past that, because, I mean, let's just talk about Captain Caveman, okay? We've come a long way, and I'm not blaming George for Captain Caveman. Not Captain Cave... Is it Cap... Corporal... Cape Man. Wow. That that was wow. Oops. I need to get some new clips. You know, I used to have more than this. So I should get some more. Captain Cape Man. So Corporal Cape Man was Horton, nothing to do with his hair. Why did, okay, anyway. Forget the hair, forget the beards. The animation is beautiful. I mean, seriously, George was never really all about, hey, this is a work of art. George was all about, look what I can do. Okay? That's all George Lucas has been about. And love him or hate him for it, the man innovates. And we can thank him for digital film, or digital filmmaking, the Sony HD cameras that they film football in. You've seen the Bravia commercials? Yeah. George Lucas helping to develop that with Sony. Yeah, thank you very much. George Lucas, also the inventor of Pixar. Yeah. He's an innovator. Innovator. He's an innovator. And nuclear. Yay. Ah, that reminds me, I need to get a whip crack sound instead of a bell for my links. Okay, gotta remember that. Where was I? Oh, right. Clone Wars. Hair. Animation. Lucas Animation Singapore is setting a new bar. You've watched Transformers Armada. You may have seen Voltron the Third Dimension. You've seen Jimmy Friggin' Neutron. This puts those to absolute shame. The blend of the near photorealistic special effects from the prequels to the characters, which aren't photorealistic, obviously. It's seamless. I mean, it's beautiful to behold. It's one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my life. Take the Clone Wars bit out of it. This isn't about Star Wars. This isn't about telling more stories. I mean, yeah, marketing to children. George has got that in the bag. But the key to this is showcasing the animation. I don't know what he's going to do with the live-action Star Wars series. I'm actually kind of hoping it's better. Oh, live tweet from Chivalry Bean, who says, I have a cool fedora from the Pendleton Woolen Mill. It rocks. Well, Chivalry Bean, that's awesome. But you know what rocks even better? Beaver pelt. You can wear that sucker in the rain and it won't matter. Because I had a wool one, Chivalry Bean. I had a wool fedora and it got wet and it shrank. Never wore it again. Could never wear it again. It's all soft and flimsy and, don't get that puppy wet, man, because wool will shrink. But the beaver pelt, that stuff, you can wear almost underwater and it'll survive. Because beavers, they go in water. Okay, moving on from the beaver subject. Mr. Beaver and Mrs. Beaver were awesome in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and that's all I'm going to say about that. The bad about the Clone Wars cartoon is horrible, horrible, horrible writing in some of them, and actually remarkably really good writing in others. It's weird. They have, you know, the typical stable of writers that most shows have, but you can really tell when it's really, really bad. For instance, one in particular. Now, for those who don't know, in between episodes, on the off days or whatever, in the middle of the week, they have a webcomic that's supposed to tie the two episodes together. Now, they did one called Dooku Captured, where Anakin and Obi-Wan are chasing down these pirates for some reason, I don't know. Oh, right, okay, the pirates, they abduct Dooku, who crash-landed on this planet, and they were scavenging his ship. Scalvaging. This is awful. Awful, awful performance tonight for me. I am not Rush Limbaugh, and maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. So anyway, the pirates have Dooku, and they send out a call. We have Dooku for ransom. Give us money. So Obi-Wan and Anakin go to the planet with the pirates. So to make a long story short, they negotiate. They do some stuff. They end this episode at a bar with drinks. Now, you see a pirate pour something in their drinks. They hand them their drinks. The two pirates to either side of the two guys of the Jedi lift their glasses in a toast. And Anakin and Obi-Wan sort of toss their glasses up with the Force and then take the other glasses down. So they switch glasses, right? Because they don't trust the pirates. And the other two pirates keel over dead. Now, here's where the problem comes in. For all you know, at the end of that episode, the other two pirates are out or dead or something. Probably out. Unconscious. And that's the last thing you see because they're, yay, we're done. It's sort of like a to be continued, but they don't say to be continued. So you end the episode thinking they switch glasses, they're cool. Well, apparently when the next episode starts, they're in a cell. Anakin. Boy, that drink was harder than I thought. Obi-Wan, we were drugged. Now, wait a minute. Caller me confused, because I thought they were fine. Apparently, the webcomic was supposed to straighten this out, but, okay, nothing but love for the guys reading the webcomic, but that's not the important part. In fact, in most cases, I listen to Nathan Butler's The Butlerniverse, and he's doing Chrono Radio Series 2, and he's talking about the Clone Wars episodes. And he says, apparently the webcomic, I don't know, explain this or something, but more often than not, from what I hear from him, the webcomic really isn't great. But the point is, if you're having a TV series, you don't expect everybody to be keeping up on the webcomic, okay? There should be some sort of link between the episodes. If it's that close together, if it's a to be continued, where's there a spot for a webcomic? Unless the webcomic services as a retcon. Oops, I made a mistake in the next episode. We better retcon this. And that's exactly what it is. You can tell me it's not, but I don't buy it. Half the stuff we can get from Lucasfilm now about the Clone Wars and continuity is nothing but, you know, CYA. It really is. It's awful. You can ask Nathan, who does the timeline. This Clone Wars continuity is all over the map. He says there's nothing, concrete about it. So he doesn't even know how to include it in canon, as it were. But anyway, that's enough of that. I'm going to get you now to the interview with Joshua Palmateer right after this message from a friend of mine and fellow podcaster. Oh, live tweets. We'll get to those in a minute.
Introducing 2 Minute Danger Theater, a podcast with an unending appetite for excitement.
Hello, I'll be your alien invader this evening.
Blast off with Commander Ranger and Cadet Nancy as they set foot on alien worlds.
The temperature is 50 degrees below zero.
It looks like we only have one spacesuit aboard the ship. You'll have to wear this bathrobe.
Trek around the globe with jungle adventurer Blake Diamond as he searches for an ancient mystical ruby.
Is that what I think it is?
Yes, I believe we've discovered the Holy Grail.
Damn it! Where's the ruby?
Wherever there's a Nazi plot to thwart or a humanitarian crisis to ignore, Blake Diamond will be there.
Lost Ark of the Covenant, map to the city of Atlantis, missing Link.
And don't forget the voice, that mysterious crime fighter who lurks in the shadows.
If you don't talk, you'll force me to use my powers of telepathy.
Oh yeah?
I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. What is it?
1.
No.
10.
No.
1.
Yes, 2-Minute Danger Theater. Just go to DangerTheater.com. Please consult a physician before listening.
Nancy, what are you doing with that llama?
Milking it, sir.
Welcome to Lesson 35 of Learn Something New, 365 lessons that teach you something new every day. Today we will learn how to climb the crime syndicate corporate ladder. Step 1. Kill anyone who gets in your way. Why question methods that work? Step 2. Kidnap and blackmail government officials. Seeing as how many government officials probably obtain their jobs this way, this will be the easiest step for everyone to follow. Step 3. Hire large henchmen to help you in your climb. These henchmen are essential in dealing with glass ceilings in business, as they usually throw your competition through them. Step 4. Setting aside time to unwind is also essential. Arrange activities that are far detached from the job, such as kinky bathtub sex or... Step 5. Never forget rule number 1. Don't trust anybody. Step 6. Never forget rule number 4. It's just fun to think about. To find out more about crime syndicates of past, present, and distant future, subscribe to Antithesis Book 1, Predestination and Other Games of Chance at antithesis.jdsawyer.net. This concludes Lesson 35, How to Climb the Crime Syndicate Corporate Ladder. See you tomorrow for Lesson 36, Zero Gravity Basket Weaving.
So, just to catch everybody up on those live tweets we just got, let's see, Bronze Thumb says... Bing, tittle, tittle, bong. I have no meaningful message. And then he says, hang on, wait, scratch that. Congrats on all those awards for Codename Starkeeper. Codename Starkeeper. You deserve them. Thank you, sir. It's very nice. Oh, you're in the room. How'd you do it? Oh, the cat came in. Hey, good job, cat. And Mr. Dubs finally says, how could you confuse us? I'm way taller and tweet with a Midwest accent. Okay, moving on to the interview with Joshua Palmateer. I'm here with Joshua Palmateer at Balticon 2008. Welcome, Joshua.
Thank you.
You having a good time so far?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's been a spectacular con.
How many Balticons have you been to? Is this your first one? Or?
No, this is actually my third. I came here 2 years ago with Patricia Bray, and she more or less introduced me to Balticon. And at that point, I just had a book out. Yeah, at that point, the first book had just come out. So I came down to see what it was all about. And then the next year, I was actually up for the Compton Crick Award.
Oh, which, okay.
Yeah, for the best first novel that year. I had some pretty heavy-duty contenders, though. I had was up against Naomi Novik and Scott Lynch for their first novels, too. So
formidable company.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I wasn't holding my breath on that one. But I heard, you know, I was a fairly strong contender for it, so so that was always good news. I had fun both years, and so now I'm back again this year, and hope to continue coming.
Tell me about The Skewed Throne was your debut novel.
The Skewed Throne is the debut novel. It's the first novel in an actual trilogy with only 3 books. Yeah, the trilogy is called The Throne of Amonkhor. So the 3 books are The Skewed Throne, book 1. The second book is called The Cracked Throne. And then the third book in the series, which just recently came out, is called The Vacant Throne.
Right.
So obviously playing off the whole throne idea. And the throne itself, you know, obviously is a central point to all 3 books. What I think is cool about the throne, what makes the throne special, is the idea is that anybody who has actually touched this particular throne, their personality is actually stored inside of that throne. And then whoever is currently ruling, whoever has touched the throne recently, as long as they can control the throne, they have access to all of those personalities and you know, all their stored knowledge. And the idea being, you know, they could get advice from all of these previous rulers. But the problem is,
there's always a problem.
The problem is that at this point in time, there are so many personalities in the throne that essentially the throne is insane. So calling the book The Insane Throne sounded kind of stupid, though.
Yeah.
So they call it The Skewed Throne instead. And all of the titles are plays off of the idea of insanity, skewed, cracked, vacant.
Right.
And so at this point in time, there's just so many there that's really, really hard to control, and it's really, really hard to actually access any useful information because you've got so many competing personalities.
Right.
So that was the premise behind the throne idea.
Got it.
In the three books. So.
You originally wrote Skewed Throne as a standalone novel, correct?
Yes, it was originally just a single book. I marketed it, you know, tried to sell it as a single standalone novel.
Mm-hmm.
But during one of the revisions, I had this little niggling idea sort of hit me. And so when Daw actually became interested in the book, one of their first questions was, you know, could there be more?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because they were interested in buying a trilogy. And so I said, well, I didn't plan on it being a trilogy, but I do have this sort of idea where it could go after this. And so I wrote up a little synopsis of where I thought it could go, and they actually thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
And so they bought all three books in the trilogy all at once, which was very, very exciting for me. So.
You like that feeling, huh?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely a good feeling. You go out and have a few drinks after that.
For sure. How long did you want to be a writer?
Oh, that's actually a good story. I decided in the eighth grade that I was going to be a writer. Because in my English professor, or English teacher in the eighth grade, she assigned us a little story. We had to write a one-page story, like handwritten one-page story. And it had to be a Twilight Zone story. And, you know, by this time I'd been reading fantasy for who knows how long. So I said, ooh, this is really cool, you know. Most of the time you get these crappy-ass stories you have to write for English. But I was like, wow! You know, and so I actually wrote this story about a man who's watching his world be destroyed by water out by looking through the porthole of a spaceship.
Hmm.
So basically it was a ripoff of Atlantis. But, you know, I was, what, 12?
Yeah.
So I wrote this story.
It's far more original than the stories I wrote when I was 12.
Well, you know, it was only a page, so you couldn't cover a whole lot of detail there. But the English teacher said that it was really well written, and she thought I should write more. And this was like a revelatory moment for me. I'm like, somebody actually writes the stories I'm reading, and that someone could be me.
Yeah.
You know? And after that, it was over. I started writing little short stories for some of the shared worlds that were coming out at the time. Like, the one that I wrote the most for was Magic in Ithkar, by Andrea Norton. She was the editor behind that shared world. And so I started writing for that, and then it wasn't until college, though, that I actually got serious about it. When I started college, I sat down and said, okay, are you doing this just for fun, or are you actually going to try to go somewhere with this? So when I hit college, I said, no, I think I want to try to go somewhere with this. And so I started seriously writing once I reached the college level.
Okay.
And then basically grad school level. And after that, once I decided to be serious about it, it took me about 10 years of writing and writing and shopping until I finally got somebody to say yes.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very long road. And in fact, Skewed Throne was obviously not the first book that I wrote. Turned out to be the fourth novel that I'd written, because I made a mistake. I wrote my first book, and instead of writing a different book after that one, even though that first one wasn't selling anywhere, I decided to write the sequel. which is not a very good idea in the long run, because if the first book doesn't sell, the sequel's not going to sell either. So so I made a small mistake there, and probably wasted a little bit of time with that. But after that, I wised up. And wrote a couple other totally different books until I hit Skewed Throne, and that one managed to catch.
Right.
Learned a lot, though, writing those other three books.
Yeah.
You know, I go back and look at the other three books, and I'm like, yeah, these weren't quite as good. It's obvious I was teaching myself how to write while I was writing those books.
Right.
So it was definitely a good learning experience in the long run.
Yeah. Now, you're a very interesting person, because you're a rare breed.
in that you use both sides of your brain.
Yes.
You're a left brain fantasy writer doing this for years, trying and trying and plugging and persevering, and yet you're a math teacher.
Yes.
How does that all work together?
Actually, well, I mean, the practical side of it is, if you're going to be a writer, you can't expect to be making a ton of money off of it right away. So the practical side was, I need something I can do that will actually pay the bills.
Right.
So one of the things I wanted to do since the sixth grade was be a math teacher. So I sort of focused in on the math and thought, the plan was that I would get the degree in math, I would teach math, and that would pay the bills. And on the side, I would write and, you know, eventually get published, I hoped. Mm-hmm. And the math would support me. So that was the practical plan. I ended up selling the book and getting my degree at the same time, which worked out rather wonderfully. And that pretty much ended the practical side of it. The really interesting thing about it, though, is that the math and the fantasy actually go together better than you might think. I end up using the math to help me write the fantasy, and then I use the fantasy to help me do the math. What I take from the math for the fantasy is math is, at its heart, all about structure. What you're interested in is you're looking for patterns, you're looking for structures. And so what I did is I took that idea about structure and I used the structure in a couple different ways in the fantasy. I use it obviously to help me plot out the books and give the books themselves a nice coherent structure. But I also use the structures for the magic. I don't go in a heavy duty mathematics in the book, but but in order for your fantasy to work, your magic system has to make sense.
Yeah.
It has to be in some sense logical. It has to follow certain rules, even if you don't know the particular rules. There has to be a sense that there's a structure behind it.
Right.
So I use the math to give the magic system a little bit of believability.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't write it out in equations or anything, because then it wouldn't be fantasy anymore. It would be math. But that's how I use the math to help the fantasy. I use the fantasy in the math field because in the math field, you're always looking to find something new or create something new or explain something that we already know in a much more subtle way.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, you have to be very, very creative. You can't think like all of the previous mathematicians thought, because if you think that way, you're just going to come up with the same things they did.
Right, right.
So what I do is I pull the creative side of writing, and I use that creative side to help me develop new mathematics.
Oh, okay.
So I think they work together rather well. But yes, I do tend to hear an awful lot that, you know, that's uncommon.
Yeah.
to be able to play in both arenas
right.
at the same time.
So you teach on the university level, State University of New York in Oneonta?
Yes, yep.
And how does that, balancing the teaching with the writing, productivity-wise?
Actually, it works out rather well. That was part of the practical plan. The idea was that I would focus on the teaching during like the fall and the spring semesters, and then I would have the entire summer off.
No.
And yes, I have that, you know, 3 or 4 months of complete free time.
That's amazing.
During the summer even. And so the idea was that, you know, I would teach and make the money that I needed to support myself during the fall and the spring semesters, and any of my off times is when I would write the books. And the original plan was that I would write the book during the summer months. Just push, try to get the book done in 3 to 4 months, which is, in general, a very reasonable plan. You know, if you write about 750 to 1,000 words a day, you can pull a book off in 3 to 4 months.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Then in the fall and the spring, when I had to focus a little bit more on the actual day job, during those months, I could actually do the revisions and do anything I needed to sort of clean up the book.
Yeah.
And that was the original plan. It turns out that you often can't finish a book in 3 to 4 months over the summer.
Right.
No matter how hard you're working at it. Especially fantasy novels, because they have a tendency to be a little bit longer than some of the other novels out there. So, like, this past year, I did it very well for the first couple books. But this past year, the new book ran a little bit longer than I thought. And so I haven't quite finished that yet, even though it was supposed to be finished last summer. So I'm finishing that up now. It was a real struggle to find time to write during the fall and the spring semester. Revisions I can handle fine. I can fit that in. But actually doing first draft versions of the stories or the novels during the semester, that's hard. So it's really, really hard to do that. But you know, the summers I can work it out. I can catch it up. And DAW is very, very nice. My editor at DAW is very, very nice about deadlines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I haven't been late on any of the deadlines yet. But she is also very good at not, you know, calling you up every day saying, you know, that's due in a month.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, yes, I know that. But she doesn't do that. And like I said, everything's worked out so far. So
that's cool. What's a typical word count for your books?
Well, it varies. The first book, Skewed Throne, is the first draft came in at probably about 85,000 words, which is actually kind of small for a fantasy.
Yeah.
Typically, like my contracts typically say that they're looking for something about 100,000 words. The first one was 85,000. One of the suggested revisions was they wanted me to actually add stuff to it, which is unusual.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they give you suggestions about what they think you could add without destroying the book or making it just fluff. So I went back and did my revisions, and that book ended up being about 92,000 words in the end. So I didn't quite make the 100,000 on that one, but you know, they didn't really care. I was close enough.
Mm-hmm.
The second book, I think I actually came in pretty close to 100,000 words. The third book, I ended up going over. I ended up at about 120,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
But Daw's really good about that as well. You know, they're not sticklers about the word count. As long as they feel like you're not padding the novel,
yeah.
then they're okay with you going over a little bit. They don't want you going over a whole lot. But I found in the third book that I just had so many characters at that point that I had to keep track of, and they all were necessary for the plot line, and so I needed to follow them all.
Mm-hmm.
And that just took a few more words than I expected initially. The current book, the start of a new series, that book is way over the word count at this point. I'm seriously going to have to go back to that one and cut out like 50,000 words.
Oh, man.
If not more.
Wow.
But it's also the first draft. It's the first draft of a new series, and I ended up writing a lot of stuff that's really, really good background material for me as the writer. It's stuff that I needed to know in order to understand the world and to understand the characters. But when it really comes down to it, that stuff doesn't need to be in the book.
Yeah.
So I think what it was is I was figuring out the world and the characters, and so the revisions, like, I already know that there's whole chapters that I'm going to go back and cut. I'm like, I don't need all of this. I can take whatever I do need from this and fit it in a paragraph here and there. Mm-hmm. and that whole chapter can go. So it's a little bit daunting to think I have to cut that many words, but at the same time, I can already look back on the book and say, oh, this can go and this can go, so I have no fear that I won't be able to cut that many.
Mm-hmm.
So the word counts can vary. Generally, though, you're shooting for right around 100,000, 120,000 words,
right,
somewhere in that length for a fantasy.
Yeah. So tell me about your experience with Online Writers Workshop.
Yes, the OWW.
How has that helped you?
It was extremely helpful at the beginning, because when I was learning how to write, I didn't take any writing classes, you know, or even though I was in the academic field.
Yeah.
I didn't take any writing classes or anything like that. I pretty much taught myself how to write, and you can only teach yourself things so far. And so what the workshop did is it allowed me to get some outside opinions of my work, and not just one or two, and certainly not opinions from like friends and family, because they're going to lie to you.
Yeah, yeah.
They're going to say it's spectacular, even though it's, you know, sucks rocks. but it gave me some outside opinions, and it taught me a lot about writing. I started thinking about writing in a lot of different ways. For example, I'd never thought about this until the workshop. You know, a scene can't just do one thing. A scene in a book needs to do two or more things. And by that I mean it can't just do something about the plot. It should advance the plot and also advance the character. Or it should advance the plot and maybe advance the setting, or the world. The world building especially is important for fantasy. But it's got to do two of those three things at least. And if you can get the scene to do all three of those things, then that's like perfect. And I don't think that that's something I would have ever realized without the workshop. I mean, just doing stuff on my own, I don't think that would have sunk in. So it's very, very helpful to get feedback from other writers, even if those aren't necessarily like published writers or anything like that. If it's just fellow writers, then, you know, they're walking the same road you are, and they will see different things in your writing, things that you are too close to,
yeah,
to actually see yourself. The other thing that writers groups are good for is that there is a lot of pain and rejection in the writing field.
Mm-hmm.
When you send out your story, you know, you're going to get rejected, and that hurts. And it's really, really good to have a group of people that you can go to and say, you know, I just got rejected, boo-hoo-hoo.
And woe is me.
Yeah, it's a support group.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can say, well, you know, I got rejected 6 months ago. Let's go out and have a drink. And, you know, and you sympathize with them, and they help you through all of those bad moments. Because even though everybody says you're going to get rejected and, you know, you have to get over it, that doesn't mean you shouldn't feel anything about it. You know, you're going to feel hurt,
mm-hmm,
because every story is, you know, your personal baby, and
right,
you don't want to see anybody putting that baby down. So, you know, it's very, very good on that front as well. So it's helpful with the writing, but it's extremely helpful with the support group.
Right.
So if you're not in a workshop or something like that, you know, see if you can get in touch with some local writers, people you can actually go to the bar with,
right?
Or, you know, go out and have dinner with when somebody gets rejected. We have a little group in where I live, Binghamton, New York.
Right.
It's me and Patricia Bray and Jennifer Dunn and
the Hard Lemonade Society.
Yeah, the Hard Lemonade Science Fiction Society. We get together. We used to get together every week and talk writing, and we would trade chapters or whatever and critique those chapters, and that worked very, very well for a while, and then it sort of degenerated into just drinking. We didn't do so much writing. We did a lot more drinking in the long run, and at this point it's degenerated even further into just gaming. We do play a lot of board games and stuff like that. But while
so it's
we
gone
drink,
from a writer's group to an old person sort of hangout.
No. We still talk writing.
The
nice thing about drinking and playing games is that you can talk about writing, and we talk about different things. At the beginning, we were critiquing each other's work and, you know, saying this is what you need to do better, or here's my query letter, you know, what do I need to do to fix it and make this query letter perfect? That's what we started off doing. Now it's more things like, you know, my agent says that I should be writing this type of book for my next project, and so, you know, we end up getting together and saying, okay, is this a good idea, is this a bad idea, what should I do? Or we present an idea and say, you know, I'd really, really like to write this urban fantasy, and here's my idea, what do you guys think?
Yeah.
So it's progressed. It used to be all about the writing itself, now it's a little bit more about the business of writing, because we're all published. So it shifted. The focus of the group has shifted slightly.
Okay. Well, he is Joshua Palmateer, and where can people find out more information about your work?
They can find out at my webpage. It would be joshuapalmateer.com.
And that's the Palmateer is spelled?
Palmateer is P-A-L-M-A-T-I-E-R.
Okay.
So joshuapalmateer.com. I also have a live journal where I blog about writing and my life and what I'm going through with writing my current book and, you know, things like that.
And you have some very... very well thought out and very and good long posts that actually provide a lot of reading material and a lot of detail.
Yes, I try really to cool. I try to talk about writing and do write. It's I call it my writing tip. That's like the tag that I put on it. It's writing tip. And yeah, I try to talk about writing and things that I've learned about the business and, you know, like I talked about my agent hunt and, you know, what trials and travails I went through during that and,
right.
and things like that. So yeah, and they're like you say, they're generally fairly long posts. But you also get things like, you know, little snippets about my daily life as well. So you get to see how writers live. At the same time,
it's kind of like a zoo.
It's a zoo, yes. It's a zoo, a writer's zoo. But that's my handle on LiveJournal is JP Sorrow, J P S O R R O W, which is not depressing. Sorrow is actually the title of the very first book I wrote, and so that's why it's called JP Sorrow.
Got it.
Not a published novel at this point, although my editor has expressed interest in publishing that one in the future. So hopefully it'll wrap around and I'll get back to that book as well. So, yeah, the webpage and the live journal are the best places to find me at this point.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for interviewing
pleasure
me.
Talking to you. You're a very compelling young man.
Oh, thank you.
All right. And you know, the thing about that interview is I really did find him compelling, and I wasn't just, patronizing the guy. I really, really enjoyed that interview, and I apologize to everyone for not getting it out sooner. I also didn't want to feel like I was just interviewing him because he was Patricia Bray's friend, and I was a fan of Patricia Bray. You know, I had never read any of Joshua's books. I still haven't. I mean to, because I keep hearing great things about them. Just haven't gotten around to it yet. And, you know, it was just a really fun interview. And so I felt like he needed his own spot, and I could just never get to where I was either able or, you know, felt like I could really squeeze it in there. And you may be asking, what about these interviews you're talking about for Codename Starkeeper? Well, Codename Starkeeper won 6 Star Wars Fan Works Fan Audio Awards. It is a community I'm a member of and didn't actually vote in because I didn't know the voting was going on. I missed the voting announcement. 2 live tweets. Nothing I can really share at this point because you'd be behind the joke. T.R. Reed started a meme. Said, famous tweet war movie, a tweet too far. And I said, famous Harrison Ford tweet movie. Air tweet one. And so he was laughing twice. Two tweets about laughing. So I say that was a successful tweet. So anyway, check out the new website over at www.indianajim.net. You will see lots of changes if you haven't been there lately. There's going to be a lot more blog posts. It used to be just a text thing. It was a placeholder because I was only using podcast. And so now I'm using the main front page. And if I do say so myself, it looks kind of pretty. Yeah, that's a word I use. So get over there and check it out. Check out the blog posts. And I'm sorry, I was interrupted about the awards. Anyway, if you go to StarWarsFanWorks.com, you will find the awards show listed in on the news page, on the front page there. I also put it out on the feed, so you probably heard it. So maybe this little thing I'm just saying here is moot. So anyway, lately I have been reading Stephen Erickson's Memories of Ice, the third in the Book of the Malazan Book of the Fallen. Yes, that's the series. Very, very big, very, very dense. If you were put off by Jordan or Goodkind, this is completely different. And
honestly, if I had to say, better. Not for the story necessarily. The story can be hard to follow because there's a lot of characters, but it is very, very compelling. There is humor in unexpected places. It's very dense. You have to really pay attention to what you're reading. It's not a series you can blaze through. It's actually something that I appreciated about the first book, and I started it, and I made it through the first few several chapters, and I'm like, oh, I can't read this right now. I was too riddled with ADD at the time. And so I picked it back up again, and I read slower. If you honestly, you read slower, it's like it makes so much more sense. There's so much going on. And the second book takes a completely different turn from the first book, and you're following completely different characters. And the third book, they come together, and it's like, ah, there's that guy. I like that guy. So anyway, check out Steven Erikson. It's not just blather from Michael A. Stackpole. The man really is good. So anyway, that's a regular show. I'm actually going to be back next week. I will have something for you. The first half of an interview with none other but the future Dark Overlord himself. I'm sorry. The future Dark Overlord himself, Scott Sigler. Scott Sigler. Yes, and you will feel his jackboot upon your neck when next we meet. But anyway, I'm out. So follow me on Twitter, Indiana Jim. Send in your emails to podcast@indianajim.net. Send in your audio feedback to the same. And be sure to visit www.indianajim.net for more blog posts in the future. And as always, thanks for listening. I mean, you know, we're going to have some more stuff for you. I'm going to have Star Wars Second Strike for you soon, one of these days. So be on the lookout for that. And here's Dr. John Smarr to tell you a little bit more. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to The Adventures of Indiana Jim, a production of Visionary Creative Works. Visit podcast.indianajim.net and leave comments on the blog. Send in your emails and audio feedback to podcast@indianajim.net. I'm Dr. John Smarr. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.